This is WGTDHD. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Guida Brown, former executive director of the Hope Council, Dr. Steve Brown, retired professor of educational leadership and school law, Dr. Karen Sconsert, chair of the education department and associate professor at Carthage College, Dr. Jonathan Shaler, professor of communications at UW Parkside, and Stephanie Skilba, Vice President for Community and Government Relations at Gateway Technical College. And now, here's today's moderator for Education Matters.
And a very pleasant good morning and welcome to this edition of Education Matters here on WGTDHD. I'm your host today, Steve Brown, and this is a rebroadcast of an interview I did back in 2009 with Ken Starr, who at the time was Dean of the School of Law at Pepperdine University in California, and also John Tinker, whose court case of Tinker versus Des Moines is still the quintessential court case when it comes to the First Amendment rights of students. By the way, this program won an award called the Golden Gavel Award from the Wisconsin Bar Association. Good morning and welcome to Education Matters here on WGTD. I'm your host, Steve Brown. On today's program, we'll be taking an in-depth look at a landmark U.S. Supreme Court case decided back in 1969 that today is still considered to be the quintessential case when it comes to students' freedom of expression in our public schools. That case was Tinker versus Des Moines. In mid-December of 1965, students across our nation were eagerly looking forward to their upcoming Christmas vacations. In Des Moines, Iowa, several students were anticipating something very different. On December 16th, 13-year-old Mary Beth Tinker, a student at Harding Junior High School, and Christopher Eckhart, a 15-year-old sophomore at Roosevelt High School, were among a handful of students who wore black armbands in support of a Christmas truce in the Vietnam War. They were all suspended from school for doing so. The next day, 15-year-old John Tinker, a junior at North High School, wore the black armband. He, too, was suspended. Thus began a court case that would lead to the U.S. Supreme Court and a landmark decision in freedom of expression. In fact, the not-for-profit Student Press Law Center describes the Tinker case as being, in their words, undoubtedly the most important First Amendment case in the nation's history. One of our very special guests today is John Tinker, whose last name, according to many, became the gold standard when it comes to the rights of students. And joining me here in our WGTD studios in Kenosha as co-host today is Howard Boltink, Professor of Educational Leadership at Northeastern Illinois University. And now a much more formal welcome to our very special guest. John Tinker lives in Fayette, Missouri, with his wife, Patricia, and their young son, Fisher. John is currently a website developer and also edits an online news and information resource internet site. John, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Glad to be with you today.
Also joining us today is Kenneth Starr, who is the Duane and Kelly Roberts Dean and Professor of Law at the Pepperdine University School of Law in Malibu, California. Dean Starr has also served as a judge for the U.S. Court of Appeals, Solicitor General of the United States, and was also the independent counsel for the Whitewater investigations during the Clinton administration. He's also the author of a delightful book, a best-selling book, First Among Equals, The Supreme Court in American Life, published in 2002. Dean Starr, welcome to Education Matters.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
At the outset, let me say that we are taping this edition of Education Matters on November 12th, exactly 40 years to the day that the Tinker case was argued before the U.S. Supreme Court.
Based upon the Tinker decision and what is now known as the Tinker Standard, which essentially states that students have the right of free speech in K-12 public schools as long as it does not create a material and substantial disruption to the educational environment, what exceptions, if any, would you make to students' freedom of expression in the classroom and at school? And that's the first question that I'll throw to Dean Starr.
Staying with the Supreme Court's teaching, speaking through Justice Fortas, in the case that bears John Tinker's name and continues to be the law of the land, the baseline is freedom, but there can be exceptions, just as there are general exceptions to the First Amendment. Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech doesn't mean that there can't be defamation laws, the laws of libel. It doesn't mean that anything goes, as Holmes said famously. You can't cry fire in a shouted in a crowded theater. Now, why is that? It is because where there are high concerns and demonstrable concerns about social evils, then, in fact, there can be regulation. So the question is, what is it that a school is trying to achieve? Liberty is the baseline. Freedom of speech is the baseline. But what is the school trying to achieve? And what the school cannot try to achieve is to limit political expression. But it can, we now know by virtue of the Morse case, create limited exceptions to the baseline rule that liberty prevails so as to forestall or prevent, as best as the school can, demonstrable social evils, as in the Morse v. Frederick case involving the concern about drug use and the celebration more generally of the drug culture at that particular public high school.
Mm-hmm. John?
Well, I agree with the baseline idea that freedom is the baseline. I think that when we're talking about exceptions and developing a list of exceptions, that we should realize that the baseline is really the most important thing, and the exceptions should come where there are problems, and where there are not problems, there should not be exceptions. In the Morse case, there's no evidence that that created a disruption. It was at a parade. It was outside of the school. It was it was the Olympic torch event was going by. There's no evidence that there was any disruption other than that caused by the by Morse insisting that the sign come down. I don't think that we should see our task here as developing some kind of an index, a compendium of exceptions.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's best for us to keep our eye on the prize here. The prize is freedom. And censorship is a known issue. It's a known problem. And so that we should wait until we have a real disruption. We should wait until we have a real problem before we impose censorship.
Mm-hmm. Let's listen to a brief excerpt from the oral arguments of November 12, 1968, for the Tinker versus Des Moines case. First, we'll hear Justice Abe Fortas, and then the attorney representing the Tinkers, Dan Johnston.
Does it matter what expression is about? Suppose some child shows up at school wearing an outlandish costume. I don't want to particularize it. And that's in violation of a regulation of the school saying that children must come to school decently clothed. And this child says, I'm wearing this outlandish costume because I want to express very strong belief that I have in the utmost freedom for the individual, you know, Kool-Aid and electronic test kit and all the things that are being written about these days. Well, this child says that's what I want to do. Does that make any difference? Does he have a constitutionally protected right With respect to that kind of expression, or would you limit it to matters of social and political importance, societal importance, as the older generation conceives it?
Justice Fortas, I believe that the real question is upon whether or not the utterance is expression, as contemplated by the First Amendment, which was a finding that the district court made, as a matter of fact, that students were engaged in expression of views privileged by the First Amendment, unless subordinated by some other state interest.
Yes, sir, that's a question. What's your opinion, if you care to express one?
My opinion would be, in that instance, that probably, again, it would depend a lot upon what the student said and the demeanor of the student when he expressed it, things of that sort, that that probably would not be within the purview of the First Amendment. But again, it's just conjecture on my part. And just to wear one's haircut the way he wants to, may present 14th Amendment problems. There's arbitrariness and things of that sort. It does not present, per se, a First Amendment problem such as we have here.
Mr. Johnson, during the negotiations, was the suggestion ever been made to limit the rule to not wearing the bands in classroom?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor.
Never was made. The board never offered that as a solution, did they?
No, they did not, Your Honor. By the time that it got finally to the board, they felt the necessity, I believe, to sustain the action of their principals.
Which school was it?
This was generally the public schools in Des Moines, three schools involved.
Great.
Mr. Eckhart was in the 10th grade, Your Honor, at Roosevelt High School. Mr. Tinker was in the 11th grade at North High School. And Mary Beth Tinker was in the 13th grade at Warren Harding Junior High School. The 8th grade at Warren Harding Junior High School.
Did your principal include the kindergarten?
To the extent, Your Honor, that those people have views and can express them within the purview of the First Amendment, it would, yes. I should not think that there would have to be a special rule for schools or any other part of our society for the First Amendment. Now, the evidence of disruption might be different. But as far as the principles apply, we'd like to have the same principles applied in the school, or perhaps especially in the school, that are applied elsewhere.
John, after listening to the oral arguments, let me ask you this question. Should the rules for freedom of speech be any different in the schools when compared to outside of the school?
The environment of the school requires that there be a different approach to freedom of speech in the schools, because speech that would be permitted on the street would be disruptive of the classroom environment. And since the education is compulsory in this country, it's important that the school environment respect the student's constitutional rights to the degree that is consistent with providing an educational environment. I'm not sure exactly what the statement is that you're referring to, Steve, but I think there's no doubt that the rule inside the school is different than on the street. I don't have any argument
with
that.
Okay. Dean Starr?
I agree fully. In fact, that is one argument that Mr. Tinker's, John's very able lawyer made that was not accepted by the court. As I understand what this very able lawyer was arguing is there should not be, and there's not need to be, a special rule for schools. The Supreme Court of the United States totally rejected that 9-0. In fact, Justice Fortas said these rules have to take into account, and John expressed it very well, the term that the court used was the special characteristics of the school environment. Just think of the controls that any teacher, of course, has to have. If the student wants to begin talking about the 2008 election, what this pretends for 2012, the future of the political party system, the future of race relations in the United States, the teacher in calculus can say, excuse me, talk about that, but not here. We're here to talk about calculus, or we're here to talk about Shakespeare. I control this. And if the student responds, but what about Mr. Jefferson and freedom of speech, then the teacher is within his or her rights by saying, excuse me, Justice Fortas said schools are different. They're not parks, they're not streets, and so forth. Mm-hmm. So I think the Supreme Court laid down that rule that, yes, freedom is the baseline, but there are, in fact, quote, special characteristics of schools that permit, therefore, what? Exceptions to the baseline rule.
Mm-hmm.
If I could say, Steve,
sure.
At the same time, we should remember that the schools in our country are where students receive their primary education about the democracy itself, about our political process, about the way our society is supposed to work. And therefore, an unwarranted suppression of speech is counterproductive in the educational environment, because we need more citizens that think for themselves and that are willing to express their thoughts. And so when you have capricious suppression of student speech, it's counterproductive, positively counterproductive for our society.
And John, the Juneau School Board would agree exactly with what you've just very eloquently said, and you use some key words, unwarranted and capricious. This Juneau School Board had a very clear policy that they continued to follow. In this case, we can all disagree about this particular case, but the school policy said political expression about social issues, et cetera, is encouraged. It's actively encouraged, but there are limited exceptions. You cannot, and this is where we might disagree, as to whether this is unwarranted, whether this is capricious, whether it's, quote, disruptive or not, but the limited school board rule that the principal scrupulously enforced is, we will not tolerate, zero tolerance for speech messages that advocate the use of alcohol and tobacco and illegal drugs.
Mm-hmm.
That was the exception that I think the Supreme Court of the United States has now embraced. And we can argue as to whether the record was strong enough in the case, but I believe what the court has done recently is really within the heartland of what the now really immortal and legendary Tinker case teaches.
Mm-hmm.
Ken, if I could ask you, let's go back decades into the Old South, and where we have laws against interracial marriage, we have laws against homosexual behavior. What if a student advocated interracial marriage in a state in, say, the 30s or the 40s, where that were against the law? Would you say the school board had the right to prohibit that speech?
No, the Tinker case would, I think, teach that the school board, because the baseline is freedom, has the burden of coming forward with justifying any exception to the baseline. So I doubt that the school board in such an instance could, because that was, of course, a very questionable policy. There were any number of national policies that suggested the inappropriateness, the immorality of this policy, and so forth. What the Juneau School Board did here, in contrast, was to say, we have documented evidence of a drug problem in this high school. It is a national epidemic. What we also know is that the use of drugs by high school students, junior high school students, is extraordinarily destructive. It destroys the educational opportunity to a great extent. And what Deborah Morse made in this on-the-spot judgment in the now colorful, if not so legendary as the Tinker case, Morse v. Frederick case, was here is someone celebrating the drug culture. If you want to be cool, you will be displaying this banner. What business did the banner celebrating drug culture have with a school event having to do with the celebration of the Olympic torch? The example is zero. Now, what Deborah Morse testified to, though, and this is undisputed, is that if the banner had said legalize marijuana use in Alaska, she probably, she's making a predictive judgment, would not have taken it down because that would have spoken to what? A political issue. And to go back to the Tinker case itself, one last point. On Tinker, one of the very important statements by Justice Fortas is that the school board, in fact, did allow political expression, did allow people to wear lapels. They objected to John and John's sister doing what? One particular form of political expression, the silent, passive wearing of a black armband to demonstrate and symbolize their protests against the Vietnam War. In other words, there was a singling out of this particular kind of protest, whereas you could have worn a John F. Kennedy or elect LBJ button, and there would have been no difficulty whatsoever.
Well, let me propose a different message that Frederick may have put on his sign. What if you would have said, bong hits for Jesus in Amsterdam? No, that wouldn't have been illegal.
No, it still would have been. My own view is, obviously, you change the facts, and who knows what the record would show.
Well, let's try it. What if he would have said no bong hits for Jesus?
At the same point. What is it that you're trying to convey? And that's what litigation was about. He brought the litigation, and they said, well, what were you trying to convey? Were you trying to convey a religious message or an anti-religious message? He said, no, I simply wanted attention. Well, why did you use the term bong hits? Because I knew it would get attention. Do you know what bong hits means? Yes, I do. And what does bong hits mean? It means the use of marijuana. So let's not kid ourselves. We can have lots of fun with lots of hypotheticals.
Really, well, sure, but this was designed to be an absurdist statement. I mean, if somebody wants to promote drug use or something, they'd say smoke pot. It would be very clear.
That's your interpretation, but you're not the school principal. The school principal was put in an on-the-spot issue, was asked to make, in effect, a snap judgment. What is going on here? This is not a radio show months later. It is not a case 35 months later. It is an on-the-spot judgment. Someone has to interpret the message. You can say, I think that was an unreasonable interpretation of the message. You would be wrong. And I think the vast majority of people who look at it say, it's a stupid message, but it's not about gonzo baboon.
I disagree a little bit about this because I'm reminded of the I grew up in public education in Iowa, and we were told about the case of abstract art and how it was treated by the Third Reich, and Hitler's abhorrence of abstract art because it was crazy and irrational and didn't make sense. I disagree with you that somebody has to interpret the message.
I didn't say someone has to interpret the message. I said someone is given responsibility, and that person is the principal of the school. And so the question isn't, is that your interpretation? Is that the better interpretation? Is it the best interpretation? It is it a reasonable interpretation? And most, I think, observers would say, if a student is going to display a message that has on it bong hits, it's about drugs.
Let me move on to the Morse versus Frederick case. Let's listen to the beginning part of the oral arguments. Dean Starr with Chief Justice Roberts introducing you, and let's let our audience hear what you had to say at the time. And this goes back to March 19th of 2007.
Your argument first today in case 06278, Morse versus Frederick. Mr. Starr?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, illegal drugs and the glorification of the drug culture are profoundly serious problems for our nation. Congress has so recognized, as has this court, time and again. The argument is that this court in Tinker articulated a rule that allows the school board's considerable discretion both in identifying the educational mission and to prevent disruption of that mission, and this is disruptive of the mission.
Well, suppose you have a mission to have a global school. Can they ban American flags on lapel pins?
Absolutely not, because under Tinker, that is political expression. Let me be very specific. This case is ultimately about drugs and other illegal substances, because it was disruptive to the event. It was disorderly to the event itself. But
what would be disorder? I don't understand this disorder. If somebody holds up a sign and says, change the marijuana laws, why is it disruptive of anything simply because the school, quite naturally, has said, we support the enforcement of the law, and the law right now does forbid the use of marijuana. Yeah, it's political speech, it seems to me. I don't see what it disrupts. And unless disruption simply means any statement of disagreement with a position officially adopted by the school. Is that what you mean by disruption?
No, Your Honor, first of all, this is, an unusual characterization, namely for this to be called political speech. We think it's a first. I'm sorry.
A call for a change in the law, I would have supposed, was political speech.
That wasn't the interpretation. Your Honor, let's back up, if I may. Someone has to interpret the message, and the frontline message interpreter is the school official. The school official.
Well, that may be, but that's not the hypo. The hypothetical is. What if there is a sign or a statement in the school calling for a change in the prohibition against marijuana use? As a call for a change in the law, I would suppose it was political speech. But as I understood the argument you were making, it would still be regarded as an exception, as it were, to Tinker, because it was disruptive. And it was disruptive in the sense that it disagreed with official school policy, which was to enforce the law or support the law as it was. Is that your position on what disruption means under Tinker?
But the answer is no.
Okay.
Because what we're also urging the court to consider is its gloss on Tinker in Frazier and also what this court said in Kuhlmeier. And in Frazier, the court was very clear, the first three paragraphs in Part 3 of the opinion, in talking about the habits and manners of civility and inculcating the values of citizenship. That, in fact, is what is happening here. There is an effort both to prevent a message that is inconsistent with a fundamental message of the schools, which is the use of illegal drugs is simply verboten. And we believe that is permitted under Tinker. But
so you want to get away from the hypothetical, then? I don't know why you try to defend a hypothetical that involves a banner that says amend the marijuana laws. That's not this case, as you see it, is it?
Well, it's certainly not this case, but
this banner was interpreted as meaning a smoke pot. No.
It was interpreted as yes. It was interpreted as an encouragement of the drug culture.
Dean Steyer, John, Howard Bolton here. Good morning.
Good morning, Howard.
Good morning. I may be a professor now, but as a backdrop, I was a school principal for 27 years, and we're kind of at a time when, you know, we're losing more and more ranks, not only of principals and superintendents, but teachers, with the additions to so many parts of our jobs, with, you know, school safety and assessment, No Child Left Behind, and the freedom of expression decisions principals make on a daily basis. And it's a very challenging job, I think, much more than it has been in a long time. And Dean Steyer, I would just like to ask, and John, feel free to join here, you know, where should we draw the boundary lines when it comes to determining a balancing test for disruptive speech and pure political expression?
I think first we have to go back, and this was in the argument and the exchange with Justice Souter, who is going to be the message interpreter, and then to what extent is that interpreter of the student's message? Is this political or is it not political? What is going on here, and as well as, is it disruptive, or as the court was willing to say, once upon a time, is it inconsistent with the educational mission? And our submission to the court, which I think carried the day, there's more than one reading of the majority opinion. Of course, there were a number of opinions, and it was 5-4 on this substantive First Amendment issue, is that there is only a requirement that the message interpreter, the principal, the teacher, have a reasonable interpretation. It may not be, to go back to our earlier discussion, the best, the optimal, the one that perhaps the English teacher or professor would say is the most logical Oxford English dictionary, but it's a reasonable one. That's very important, it seems to me, in terms of the educational function in carrying it out. What Tinker, again, it seems to me, stands for at its purest is that political expression is presumptively all right. But even there, if the court is satisfied, the finder of fact, the district court is satisfied, that that message in the educational environment is disruptive, then it can, in fact, be removed. So that creates some very potentially hard hypotheticals. The reason that I think that the majority of the court found this not a difficult case is because of the drug-laden, the drug-infested nature of Joseph's speech. If he had called more clearly for a political consequence, namely legalize marijuana in Alaska, then again, Deborah Moore said, I may not have even asked him to take it down. Now, why is that? And Howard, this goes to your observations, and I'll be very brief about this. One of the very intriguing things about her testimony was that the principal of the school had read the Tinker case, had read the other two major school free speech cases, was steeped in the law, so it was not as if the teacher was just making an intuitive on-the-spot judgment as the proverbial cop on the beat. She brought to the decision-making process training in the First Amendment law, but she also knew the culture at Juneau Douglas High School, and she knew that the use of drugs was, and I gather still is, a serious problem in that particular school. That's what she was responding to.
If I may say, I think there's a kind of a deeper level discussion that really needs to take place. I don't know if this is, probably don't have time to do it, but I just heard on the radio a few days ago that in England they rescheduled the marijuana from being a Class B substance to being a Class C substance, so they reduced the penalties for possession and so on. And the result was a lowering of the marijuana use. Now, in doing the little bit of research for this program right now, I encountered some student websites, and there's just total disrespect for the opinion among the students, and there's no shortage of drug-induced banter flying about regarding this case. And what I think we're formulating this as authority versus libertine youth or something like that. And what we're missing is that there has to be real communication between the existing authority in our society and the upcoming generation. There has to be an actual conversation. If we need a conversation about drug use, how many people are in prison right now for marijuana use, possession? What's this doing to our society? A student that might be thinking about this and wanting to introduce the subject and wants to bring the topic up and is wondering how to do it, and he puts together a sign like Long Hits for Jesus, to me it's an expression of absurdity, but it's a valid communication. It's like a work of art. It's like a piece of poetry. And we should really look at it and not just suppress it, not just tell them, no, you can't talk about that, because that never works anyway.
Dean Starr, relative to the Morse case, the bong hits case, how did you explain to the court that the bong hits banner was, in fact, a disruption to the school environment, even though the student was standing off campus? Because I know some have made an issue, a point to mention that that Joseph was standing off campus when he did this.
Right, and all nine justices agreed that this was, in fact, a school event and a school speech. The key points really are that the event was during normal school hours. It was sanctioned by the school authorities as an approved social event, and at approved improve social events, imagine going off to a museum or other field trip, under, I would assume, the law, the regulations of most school districts, certainly it's true in Juneau, that the student conduct rules expressly apply under those circumstances. Teachers were there, administrators were there. This was, again, as was pointed out during the course of the litigation, Joseph could have chosen to march down the street, separating himself from his confrères, and displayed the banner away from the school community, and he would have stood unmolested. It was that he inserted himself, of course, quite deliberately. That was part of the idea, to be part of the school community, to stand among the other students, and then directing his banner toward the school. No justice disagreed with that. And I don't think, in fact, no judge along the way, including the judges who voted in favor of Joseph Frederick, said, oh, he should win because he wasn't really participating in a regulatable event.
John, you have a reaction to that?
Well, I can accept that if everybody seems to agree that was a school event. I can go along with it being that it was a school event, but it wasn't a trip to a museum. It was a parade, and if his behavior was inappropriate to unfurl a banner, then I mean, if they were visiting a church or a synagogue, it would be inappropriate to unfurl a banner. And so that would be disruptive in any case. But in this case, it was not disruptive.
Well, I think we need to focus again on does Tinker stand for the proposition that there can only be, quote, disruption, and that the parade stops, fisticuffs break out, and so forth? And there, I think, is a very rich area for conversation. The reason that the banner was suppressed was because of its message, because it was a pro-drug message. It wasn't a pro-Olympics message. It wasn't a pro-Governor Palin or anti-Governor Palin message. It was about drugs. That's what the Juneau School Board has directed. So the complaint really is with the duly elected Juneau School Board that then fashioned a policy that says basically two things. Policy 5520, which is laid out in the court's opinion, is really very clear. One, freedom of speech prevails here. Secondly, there are very limited categories of speech that are not allowed. Don't advocate alcohol use. Off with the T-shirt. Don't advocate tobacco use. Off with the T-shirt. And don't advocate, this is where we might disagree, but I guess in light of the conversation, people would probably agree if the banner had said more clearly, use marijuana, it will help you in your studies, or simply use marijuana, it's a good thing, or use marijuana, England has reduced the use of marijuana from a class, whatever. You see where I'm going mm-hmm. with this. Then that is more clearly a political message. And again, Deborah Moore says, if you give me a political message, I'm enjoined by the school board not to interfere with political messages. And that's, I think, something that is very important in terms of this principle, making this decision, this snap judgment, especially when, and I don't say this is decisive by any means in the case, all Joseph had to do was to go one block away and do precisely the same thing, and he would have been unmolested. The key is, this was in the school and violating a school, mm-hmm. excuse me, it was at a school event and violating a school policy.
Dean Starr, Justice Ginsburg posed this question to you, and maybe if you can just respond for us in terms of how you responded back to her. What if Joseph had unfurled the banner where he was standing, not a block down, as you were, you know, as another way he could have done it, and the banner said, "Bong stinks for Jesus." Would you think this would have the same end result for Joseph?
I don't know what Deborah Morris, the principal, would have done. Again, I have to put myself into the position of what is the school principal? She's the key. It's not my view. It's mm-hmm. not your view. It's what the school principal thinks. And bong stinks does not, as far as I know, have a generally accepted meaning. But Deborah Morse, steeped in what the culture is of that school, knew full well, and so did the student body. They're not naive. They knew exactly what bong hits was. Changed the nature of the message, and perhaps the principal would have made a different kind of decision.
John Dean Starr, what does the future hold when it comes to public schools disciplining students for misconduct that takes place off school property? You know, for example, like using their own internet connection at home to create a private website with specific references about the student's public school. What does the future hold for school administrators, John Dean Starr?
In my opinion, it's the future's not very bright for the students themselves, and I think the administration the school administrators are being given the green light in lots and lots of ways to come up with a rationalization and carve out an exception. And it's like, I'm not a lawyer. I don't want to be a lawyer. And I think I have that in common with large numbers of people. And we need a law that reads like it means. And when it says freedom of speech, we expect freedom of speech. And not to have this long index or long list of exceptions phrased in language that we don't understand. That's why if the rule were clearly, if there had been no Kuhlmeier or no Frazier, then it would be the principal would not be confused about her role.
Mm-hmm. Dean Starr, why do you think that the Tinker case continues to be such a remarkable one and is still cited for cases not only for students but for teachers and individual rights of school employees and public employees?
Because of its fundamental insight in the memorable language of Justice Fortas, and I embrace this language that students do not shed their constitutional rights at the schoolhouse gates. They continue to be protected individuals, protected in terms of their basic rights to express themselves. I love Obama. I love McCain. And to do that in an unmolested way. And yet at the same time, and this is the other side of the coin, that the school does, in fact, I think we are in agreement on this, special characteristics that permit greater regulation than otherwise would be permitted.
Mm-hmm. And John, I'll give you the final word in terms of why you think the Tinker case that bears your name, along with your sisters, has remained such an important case with respect to the rights of students.
I think our case, we avoided a lot of these ambiguities. It was a civil time in the schools. We presented ourselves very civilly. We had a thought-out position. We were not trying to disrupt. We were trying to influence people with our ideas about the war.
Mm-hmm.
And so our case came through with a certain purity of form, I guess. And that's, I think, why it's lasted. But I worry about the kids who are facing absurdities in this world and mm-hmm. can't figure out how to express what they're thinking
sure.
about.
I'd like to thank our very special guest this morning here on Education Matters, John Tinker, who joined us from his home in Fayette, Missouri, and Kenneth Starr, Dean of the School of Law at Pepperdine University. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us this morning here on Education Matters. Also, let me thank Howard Boltink, who joined me here in the studios at WGTD. For Education Matters, I'm your host, Steve Brown. Thank you so much for listening.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard Saturday mornings at 10:30 here on WGTD. Archive programs are available on our website at WGTD.org.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, the Kenosha County Aging and Disability Resource Center and the Alzheimer's Association offers a monthly memory cafe. It's held the second Tuesday of each month from 1 until 2 p.m. Call 800-272-3900.
I'm Gregory Berg, and I hope that you can listen to Monday's morning show here on WGTD. This month marks the 10th anniversary of the landmark U.S. Supreme Court decision that made marital equality the law of the land. In honor of that, I speak with Frankie Frankeny, co-author of a book called Love, The Heroic Stories of Marriage Equality.